The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was the single most important piece of legislation passed by Congress in American history. It gave the government sweeping powers to strike down segregation, to enforce fair hiring practices, and to rectify bias in law enforcement and in the courts. In the new book, The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act, Clay Risen unfolds the struggle waged from the streets of the Deep South to the halls of Congress to bring the bill into law. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Clay Risen to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
Again, the title of the book, The Bill of the Century. What brought you to this particular look at, as I mentioned in the introduction, one of the most important pieces of legislation passed by Congress?
Well, I grew up in the 80s and in Nashville, actually. And, I think for anyone who grew up in that period, you're aware of a certain, racial reality, but not really what brought it about. I think the Civil Rights Act is one of those things that's sort of there in plain sight. We all know that it happened, and we know that it's important, but we don't really know how it happened, and we don't really understand the impact that it had. Growing up, like I said, in the South, you were told, well, segregation used to be legal, now it's not. But how did that happen? How did that come about? Who were the people who made it happen? Who resisted? Why did they resist? And how did justice eventually come out on top? So that's what I wanted to answer with this book.
It is a fascinating story because in many ways you can look at the timeline and see that all of this sort of unfolded over a year. But the fact that it had been sort of in the works and your story goes into much more depth, that the timeline is much longer.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's funny because there was, obviously there was the movement that we all, aware of really, got going in the South in the mid-50s under Martin Luther King, and actually went back much further around other people. But, by the early 60s, there was a real growing pressure from not just the civil rights community, but the labor community, the religious community, large parts of the political community, really pushing for some kind of legislation. And so a lot of what I do is kind of prologue for the book is show how the resistance by the establishment, by the Kennedy administration, in fact, who we think of as very pro-civil rights, actually was very very hesitant to get involved. And what was it that made them change their minds so that in mid-1963, the administration and President Kennedy decided, okay, we are going to do something major on this and effectively turn around. So, what were the forces behind them pushing them? So it very much was a kind of a pressure politics going on.
Speak a little bit about the hesitation on behalf of the Kennedy administration, of what their concerns were. And in some cases in the book, you get the idea that you almost needed the time to work it all out.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, Kennedy ran on civil rights. He was probably largely politically motivated. He knew he needed the black vote to win in 1960. But I think, look, he wasn't against civil rights. He was aware that it was an issue. But, for him, it was one of many issues. I mean, he saw it as, probably not as important as winning the Cold War, for example. He also had a lot of other domestic policies that he wanted to get done. And this was just one of those things. And at the same time, he was very beholden, as a lot of Democratic presidents were, to the South. Franklin Roosevelt had the same problem. Harry Truman had the same problem. The South was very powerful as a political bloc in Congress, and also very pro-segregation, very against anything that would change, that would strike against what they call the Jim Crow system of laws and cultures in the South. And so, for Kennedy, it really just wasn't, it was something that he, in an ideal world, probably would have loved to have seen happen, but was not willing to sacrifice a lot of political capital to do it. And I think you're right, that it took time, it took a period where he was in office, where he got to be involved in sort of as the forefront of the federal government, seeing how difficult it was for the movement, for states and local activists to actually make any sort of progress. I mean, that was always his hope that, you know, the thing, he sort of felt like things will take care of themselves, and that's kind of the way we want things to go. And you know, through 1962, 63, I mean, really coming to a head with the Birmingham protests that Martin Luther King so masterfully orchestrated to demonstrate the failure of anything other than the federal government to make real change for justice in the South. I think that's what finally brought around Kennedy, and he was able to say, okay, I've been here long enough, I've seen what happens without us, we need to do something.
Ultimately, on July 2nd, it was Lyndon Johnson to sign the Civil Rights Act. What brought Lyndon Johnson on the side of this legislation to fight so hard for it?
Well, I think there are two things. I mean, Lyndon Johnson is a fascinating character, as people know, because he's this great mix of idealism and pure Machiavellian pragmatism. And, you know, I think that anyone who's read Robert Caro's work knows that, you know, there probably is, or, you know, he demonstrates pretty well that, you know, Johnson, when he was climbing up to the presidency, was very much the Machiavellian side had the upper hand. But once he was in office, and really when he was the vice president, even, he started to lose some of that, or that side started to retreat a little bit. It was still there and always was there, but the idealism started to come out a bit. And when he became president, I think that he saw this as an opportunity to do something that appealed to, that sort of won out that sense of moral vision that he had. And he did this with other things, with the war on poverty, with voting rights. You know, at the same time, though, I think that you can't discount his pragmatic side in pushing for civil rights. You know, he knew that if he was going to be in office and he wanted to do all these other things, he had a long agenda of things he wanted to get done. At the very beginning, he had to get the liberals behind him. And he says this over and over in tapes and transcripts and memoirs of people who are around him in late 63 after Kennedy was assassinated. You know, he was saying, look, if I want to win the country in 1964, win the election, I need to do something to really shore up my liberal base because these people don't really like me. So doing civil rights and making it something sort of as the legacy of John F. Kennedy, definitely was a good pragmatic choice. But I think you really have to see both sides going on in order to understand why Johnson was so strong behind this bill.
When you think of... With that said, how instrumental was he? I mean, you take him out of the equation, and it would have been very difficult.
I think he was instrumental. I mean, one of the things, sort of the case that I make in the book is, you know, there's kind of this myth that he was in the back rooms doing a lot of deals with senators, and actually he wasn't. He didn't spend a lot of time on the Hill. He had, during his time in office in the 50s, when he was Senate Majority Leader, he had made a lot of enemies, and there were a lot of people who just didn't want him around. He had some very good people who were doing things for him. Hubert Humphrey, as kind of the senator leading the charge. Nick Katzenbach, who is his Deputy Attorney General, was really, you know, working kind of the lobbying side for the administration. And yeah, Johnson knew he could kind of let these guys run the show on the tactical level. What Johnson did that was even more important, I think, than being in there kind of finagling and arm-twisting was making a moral stand, the moral case to the public. He was able very masterfully from the very beginning. I mean, his first speech before Congress and to the country after Kennedy's assassination, he gets up in the Capitol. The very first thing he says is, you know, to fulfill the legacy of John F. Kennedy, we have to pass a civil rights bill. And all through this speech, he goes back to that point again and again. And then all through 1964, anytime he has a chance to speak before the public at political conventions, at, you know, rallies, he's starting to do some campaigning, every single time, every press conference, every time he says, not only does he say, we need a civil rights bill, he says, I won't accept a compromise. I will only accept the full bill, which is enormous, because people would have expected, you know, Johnson will eventually cave and he'll let a tiny bill come through as a way of, you know, getting something out. But he instead took a very maximalist stand. He said, you know, this has to happen exactly the way it was written. And that gave an enormous amount of momentum to guys on the inside who were doing the negotiating, but also to the country, to the people who are watching on TV and writing to their senators saying, I want this to happen. I hear what the president's saying. I support him. Let's do this. You know, to the senators who were on the fence. I mean, there were a lot of senators who, you know, it wasn't that they supported Jim Crow, but they just didn't care very much, and they didn't see why this was such a big deal. When they heard Johnson giving these speeches, they understood, okay, this is what we need to happen, and we need to have happen. And I think that that contributed enormously to the bill's success.
With that said, it seemed inevitable that there would be a filibuster.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There was no chance that there wouldn't be a filibuster. In fact, the whole way that the bill was constructed was to confront a filibuster. And, you know, from the very beginning, when Kennedy sat down with his team, his advisors, and some of his key senators in middle of 63, they said, okay, we know this bill is going to get a filibuster. How do we design it so that it brings in enough of these kind of fence sitters? Because you had to have two-thirds at the time. You had to have two-thirds of the Senate support a movement to end the debate, right? If more than two-thirds wanted to keep debating, then you had to keep debating. So you have to bring over a bunch of people to your side. And so the bill was written very cleverly to appeal to those. And a lot of the story of how the bill moved through Congress, and you know, I tell this, focus on this a lot in the book, how it moved through Congress was there's a lot of fine-tuning and sort of back and forth about, okay, how do we get this bill perfect? When it gets to the filibuster, how do we make it so that the people who might not vote for it otherwise will come over to our side? So it's a very interesting kind of political sort of how do you craft a bill that's going to face this immense challenge?
When you think of that immense challenge, when it was passed, I'm interested in your sense of how it became then justified by those who opposed it. That suddenly, and some, it took a very long time, and some not that long, of starting to embrace it.
Yeah, you know, that's it's a tricky question. And you, again, having grown up in the post Jim Crow South, you know, you really saw what I think is kind of an ambivalent reaction. I mean, on the one hand, it's true that there were a lot of Southerners, particularly young Southerners, who just wanted the issue to go away and either didn't care about civil rights. Maybe some of them even agreed with the case for civil rights action, but for the most part, they were just tired of all of this as kind of an albatross around their neck. Not all of them did. Obviously, a lot of people were very unhappy with it. But you know, it was one of the reasons the bill was as successful as it was in terms of implementation was because it spent all of this time in Congress and being debated, and ultimately was a very strong federal bill. It made it easier for people in the South, white people in the South, to say, okay, there's nothing we can do about it. This is the law. And it was tested before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court approved it. So, you know, but what happened was a real separation. I mean, if you had legal segregation beforehand, where it was enforced in a lot of places as either culture or the law, afterward you had, a real separation of the races. I mean, when I grew up, in suburban Nashville, and I can tell you I probably didn't know more than four or five black people growing up. And it was just not an issue at all. And of course it was, but in the background, but it wasn't something that I was exposed to. Unlike my father, who grew up in Nashville in the 40s and 50s, and for him, he interacted with black people all the time, but it was in kind of that Jim Crow structure. So it's a weird sort of transition, and it's obviously better by far. But I think that there's still a lot of challenges that certainly the South faces in terms of race relations, but I think the whole country. The bill was very important. I call it the bill of the century, but no one should be under the illusion that it solved our racial problems.
Absolutely. The title of the book, Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. It is published by Bloomsbury Press. Clay Risen, thank you very much for spending time with us. I do appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, Joe.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Bill of the Century, published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.